There is a familiar story in business and in entertainment, a kind of modern myth, really. It's the story of the lone, rugged, but artful individual who's been trying to live out their dream and keeps coming up short. Short on optimism, even shorter on resources. They give it one last try, not because it's smart, not because it makes sense, but because they don't know what else to do. And somehow, in that urgency, something clicks. Just when, by all practical metrics, they should stop. They lean fully into the one thing that only they can do. Into what might look like a limitation, or an oddity, or a liability. And by embracing their own uniqueness, they find a more general kind of success. I'm obsessed with that story. I love hearing how people build their own brands and businesses. On the most basic creative level, I'm always drawn to the moment when somebody says, "It only worked when I finally committed to my voice, my vision, and stopped trying to be anything else." And while this podcast, The Third Story, has certainly grown over the years, I sometimes wonder if what it's missing is my own desperation. Maybe it would be more successful if I had less to lose. Maybe I'm not quite hopeless enough. At least not yet. Then again, in the words of Mose Allison, I'm not discouraged, but I'm getting there. And that may be the good news, because as my new friend Dan Pashman will tell you, you can never underestimate the power of desperation. Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Dan Pashman is one of those increasingly rare people who always wanted to be in radio. His career began at the turn of the millennium as a producer and reporter for NPR, Air America, and Sirius XM. But after years of industry contraction and layoffs, he went through six of them in under a decade, Dan found himself at a crossroads, just as podcasting was quietly emerging as a new frontier. So in 2010, he created The Sporkful, a podcast he describes as being for eaters, not foodies. With a decade of false starts behind him and a young family in front of him, he saw the podcast as his last real shot at the career he'd imagined. Dan had always been somewhat obsessed with food, and this was his chance to shine a light on something he cared about personally. He built it on curiosity, humor, and an almost comical level of rigor. It began as a place to obsess over ice cubes, grilled cheese sandwiches, and cereal milk. And slowly it evolved into something much larger. Over time, The Sporkful grew into a platform for exploring culture, identity, business, and human connection, using food as the point of entry. That evolution reached a turning point when Dan embarked on a multi-year, deeply personal experiment, inventing a brand new pasta shape called Cascatelli. The project became a narrative podcast series, an award-winning creative risk, and eventually, it became a real product on grocery store shelves. Part of what makes The Sporkful work so well is Dan's willingness to let his personal point of view lead the way. He's a perfect embodiment of that story that I love, the idea that embracing individuality is what allows a project to resonate. His success also coincided with the moment food became popular culture. Whether by instinct or by timing, he got in just as food was on the way up. And The Sporkful also opened the door to other opportunities for Dan, including his segment on the Cooking Channel called You're Eating It Wrong, and two cookbooks. So we got together recently to talk about creative obsession, building a sustainable podcast business, the tension between audio and video in today's podcast landscape, integrating ads without losing trust. It's a candid, process-oriented look at how a modern creative career actually gets built, one forkful at a time. Speaking of building things carefully, one area where I'm still learning is how to integrate advertising without losing trust. If I'm going to sell you something, I need to believe in it. And ideally, I'd like to be a customer too. That's why I'm happy to talk to you about Musication. Musication provides in-home music lessons in Brooklyn and Manhattan for children ages 3 and up. Their teachers are experienced professional musicians, and every lesson is built around each student's individual interests with flexible scheduling to fit family life. In my house, we've used Musication for my own daughter, Sol, for years. Musication was founded by my friend Jeremy Zamuda, a dedicated musician and educator. Watching him build a community around a clear, generous idea has been inspiring, and it's another example of someone who simply went for it. As a special offer for Third Story listeners, visit musication.nyc, mention the podcast, and you'll receive two free trial lessons. Visit third-story.com for the full archive. Hundreds of deep dives like this one, including past episodes with radio and podcast adjacent voices like Michael Feldman, Ben Wickler, who gets a shout out in today's conversation, and even my dad, Ben, who was an early NPR host. You can also find regular writings, musings, and ways to support the project on Substack. It's leosidran.substack.com. And remember, The Third Story is made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for more of their award-winning content. Here's me and Dan Pashman talking it down. Just give me a little 1-2.
1-2. I'm just here in Brooklyn with Leo. Good to see the old neighborhood on a beautiful sunny day. I think I might get lunch at Miriam before I head back to Long Island for my daughter's tennis match.
So, Dan Pashman, what is happening to me right now is something that people describe when talking to me, but I'm experiencing it talking to you, which is that, you know, you're a three-dimensional physical person.
Right.
And the voice coming out of the face almost feels kind of like incongruous. It's sort of like, because we invent our own image of what that voice is.
Yeah, I'm sure people say the same thing to you from listening to you, but it's like, that voice is coming out of that head. That's weird.
It is a little bit of a disconnect, but it is a pleasure to meet you in real life.
Thanks for having me in your beautiful home creative studio space.
Totally. As I've been thinking about kind of getting ready to talk to you, something that has sort of occurred to me is that we arrived at somewhat similar places, but we took very divergent paths. One of the things that inspired me to start doing this 11 years ago, interviewing people, was Marc Maron. This was before he was interviewing musicians. You know, I thought I could do that. I could ask people to come to my house and kind of unpack their experience and try to figure out what we share in common or whatever. And I sort of became not necessarily a journalist, although I think today I do operate a little bit as a journalist, but I came at it from being a working musician who felt that I had something to offer.
Right.
You, I learned in preparing for this, passed through a little bit of overlap with Maron also because you were in radio and broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, when I graduated from college in 1999, my dream was to host my own radio show.
Yeah.
I had a radio show in college. I wanted to be on the radio. And so my first 8 or so years after college was me getting jobs as producers in various radio stations and networks, trying to work my way up. And one of those early jobs, so some of those were more journalistic. Some of them were more, or less journalistic. Yeah. One of them being with Maron, which was, you know, journalistic-ish.
At Air America.
Right. It was at Air America Radio, which was a progressive talk radio network that launched in 2004, kind of intended to try to counter the right-wing dominance of talk radio at the time. Al Franken was the biggest star. Rachel Maddow was there, but back then nobody knew who she was.
I remember. Was Ben Wickler there?
Ben Wickler was there, who's now like the number two person in the Democratic Party.
Yeah.
Liz Winstead, one of the co-creators of The Daily Show. Chuck D from Public Enemy. Janine Garofalo, Sam Cedar.
Yeah.
So incredibly talented people. And I was assigned to work on The Morning Show, which was hosted by Marc Maron, who at that time was only a comedian and occasional actor. He was not a radio, an audio host as we know him today. But I had the keys to the office. I'd come in at 2 o'clock in the morning, read all the news, put together kind of a bulletin. Our show was certainly newsy and there were some very serious segments. And we interviewed congressmen and senators and important folks, but also we had comedy bits and comedy writers, you know. So the show was also very funny. You know, it's always similar to like The Daily Show.
Yes.
In a morning radio form.
Yes. I mean, it sounds like a dream job for somebody like you who was into a lot of things and wanted to be on
the radio. It was my first full-time job in radio when I was 24. I moved to New York City. You know, that was the first of two morning shows I worked on. The show went on the air live at 6 o'clock in the morning. So you develop a sort of bunker mentality with the people that you're working with because, you know, I'm there at 2 or 3. Maron and the rest of the crew showed up at 4 a.m. So you're kind of all in this sort of alternate universe.
Yes.
And so we just got very tight. I'm still friends with a lot of those people. And I was learning so much. There were so many smart, talented people at Air America in those early days. So it was just like a very exciting, very dynamic.
Yeah.
Just to put it in perspective for people who don't know about Air America, because it went out of business. But like the week that Air America launched, Al Franken was on the cover of the New York Times Magazine. Like it was an exciting thing. And I'm like, oh my God, like I work there.
So I totally remember it as a response to right-wing media. I mean, interestingly, as we look back 20 years later at the polarization in the conversation, it made perfect sense to me. I mean, I remember Franken's books about kind of pulling the curtain back on right-wing media, Lies and the Lying Liars, Who Tell Them was one of them. It made sense that the left should have its own response to that. Although looking back on it, I can see that it it has led us, especially through social media, to these like very siloed positions today.
No, for sure. Like Air America went under for several different factors. I mean, the initial like CEO turned out to be kind of corrupt.
Yeah.
And then after that, it kind of went through a series of kind of like wealthy caretaker owners who kind of didn't really have the patience to grow it.
Yeah.
But it also launched in 2004 when radio in general was already kind of starting to be in decline. So like if it had launched in 1987, I'd be very curious to know what would have happened. You know, like the heyday of sort of Howard Stern as a shock jock and Rush Limbaugh as the preeminent right-wing talk radio host with a million imitators underneath him.
Yep.
If it had come out then, I'm curious.
Yes.
But like by the time we got it together, it was kind of like we didn't have the right ownership and it was kind of too late.
But you got your foot in the door and you started doing it. And
yeah.
It was one of a large handful of jobs that you got and lost in a short amount of time.
That's right. I had the bad luck of coming out of college, like I said, at this time when I wanted to work in radio and radio was kind of already in decline.
Yeah.
And there were two major recessions in my first 8 years out of college.
Yeah.
So the combination of entering an industry that I didn't realize when I first entered it, but turned out to be in decline,
yeah,
and two major recessions that sped up the decline.
Yeah.
I would keep getting jobs on a radio show thinking, this is it. I'm going to work my ass off for the next 20 years. And, you know, in 10 years, I'll have the overnight show. And in 20 years, I'll be the afternoon drive time guy. And then 6 months later, they would cancel the show and I'd be laid off. And I got laid off from like six jobs in 8 years.
Yeah.
I was beginning to have to wonder, like, maybe I'm just not going to be able to have this career.
Yeah.
And that was when friends of mine started telling me about podcasting, like 2009.
Yeah.
Most people hadn't heard of podcasting, but because I worked in radio, we were kind of, everyone was like, this is going to be the next thing.
You could see it coming.
Yeah.
Before we get there, and this is good, we've set the stage. You grew up in New Jersey.
Yes.
What was the family like?
My dad's a lawyer. His dad was a lawyer and a judge. My brother's a lawyer. My cousin's a lawyer. So I come from a long line of lawyers.
Which is why you actually considered, after being laid off so many times, maybe I have to become a lawyer.
Right. At two different points in my 20s, I went online to see when the next LSAT was being given because I was like, you know, I'd be unemployed and I'd be like, let me just find out when the next LSAT is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, applying to law school isn't something you do in 2 days.
Yes.
Let me start that moving and I'll see, you know, let me take the LSAT. And look, by the time it comes time to apply to law school and decide if I'm going, maybe I'll have a good job by then. Both times when I looked, it was like a week after the last LSAT for that admission cycle had been given. And I was like, oh, well, I'll check back in 6 months. And then 6 months later, I'd have another job.
Hmm.
And so, but I do think that I have a sort of lawyerly analytical brain.
Yes.
And that does still come into play even as a food podcaster in ways that people might not expect.
Yes.
Also, I grew up in a very food-obsessed family.
Well, I've heard you say that. And at the same time, you know, ultimately, the food project that you started is kind of overtly non-highbrow in a sense.
No, no, 100%. Yeah.
It's not for foodies. It's for eaters. It sort of like rejects the idea of food as being something that doesn't belong to all of us. And it turns that on its head and says, no, food, we all eat. We all love food.
Right.
So what does it mean to be a food-obsessed family? What do you mean when you say that?
Well, if we were ever traveling anywhere, this is in the days before the internet, my mom would have like a folder of magazine clippings and articles of restaurants that she wanted to go to. We had a trip in 1986, 87 to visit my aunt who had moved to Houston. We went to Houston. That was the first time I had fajitas. Nowadays, there's hardly such thing as regional cuisine. I mean, some things are better in their home regions, but you can kind of get them anywhere.
Yes.
I had never seen fajitas as a 10-year-old growing up in New Jersey. And I was like, oh my God, like flour tortillas are incredible.
Yeah.
And we came back to New Jersey and that ushered in like the great Pashman family fajita craze of the late 80s and early 90s. There was like always a flank steak marinating in the basement fridge. We had a lot of fajitas. So it was like my mom would get into something and like we would have it. Like, you know, just food was always a focal point. We'd always talk about what we're going to eat, talk about how much we enjoyed it.
Yeah. Cooking, familiar in the kitchen? Were you comfortable in the kitchen?
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, my mom was a very good cook.
Yeah.
And I, you know, my dad taught me how to make scrambled eggs. My brother and I would make like egg and cheese sandwiches when we were kids. So some basic stuff, but I wouldn't say that I was like any kind of great cook or the most adventurous eater as a kid either.
So interestingly, what you describe, I relate to also. We're pretty much exactly the same age. You're a little younger than me, but we graduated from all the things at the same time. I graduated from college in 99 also. I grew up in Madison, Wisconsin. With Ben Wickler. He's a couple years behind
me. Oh, you
know
him? Yeah. Oh, that's cool. Yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, I remember in a city like Madison when a certain cuisine would come, you know, sushi was a big deal when it showed up in Madison and my parents took me. And also I remember my mom discovering risotto at some point when I was in high school and she was like, this is risotto. This is how you make it. You have to keep stirring it. Right, you have to help me every Wednesday. I make risotto now. And that became a thing. But as I hear you talk about it, I can tell that you were sort of fascinated by, like, what's the best way to melt cheese on something? What's it like, all these kind of questions about how much time to leave the milk in the cereal, all these, like, that's your analytical brain, I think, operating on top of food.
For sure. Analytical and somewhat obsessive.
Yes.
Like, I am definitely the kind of person who obsesses over the details of all kinds of things.
Yeah.
Which I sort of find enjoyable most of the time. The people around me might find it annoying.
Yeah.
And because I'm sort of food obsessed and generally someone who likes to unpack the smallest details of everything.
Yeah.
Yes, I was that way. Although it wasn't until I started getting on my podcast that I fully realized.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of vaguely knew that I had this personality, but it's kind of one of these sort of usual suspects moments where, like, you look back and suddenly you're like, how could I have missed all of these clues that were right in front of me?
If your career starts with a question of bad timing where you enter the radio space when radio is kind of in decline, it also coincides with the rise of sort of food. You know, I grew up in a music household and my mom, I remember 20 years ago, started saying to me, food is rock and roll. Food is the new rock and roll. Whatever rock and roll was to the 60s, food is to the sort of Y2K period. Like, suddenly chefs are celebrities and, like, television is about watching people make food and travel shows are built around food and talking about the way we organize ourselves, you know, culturally around food becomes the major narrative, and that becomes the thing that you choose to hang your, you know, hat on.
Yeah.
It's very fortunate, I think, time-wise.
Yeah, no, for sure. Yeah, I mean, certainly, like, you know, the rise of Food Network in the 90s was a big part of it.
Yeah.
But I was also, as much as I love food, I was never obsessed with food media. I was never the person who would sit and watch cooking shows for hours.
Yeah.
I liked to cook, but I wasn't the person who was, like, rushing out to buy all the cookbooks and try all the hot new recipes. I really just loved to eat.
Hmm.
And that was part of the sort of founding idea of The Sporkful, which was that I was somewhat turned off by the culture of food that was on the rise and is still a big part of it to this day, which is very much like food as status. I'm still to this day not that interested. Like, I'm curious to hear about good restaurants because I like to eat good food.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to brag, like, or, you know, and I'm turned off by people who are like, oh, well, have you, you know, it's impossible to get in there. Like, shut up. I don't care. I'm not going to wait for a table for any place.
Yes.
You know, like, there's other good places.
You know, it's funny. I made these T-shirts during COVID that say Kenji debunked it because we had this little pod of four families that would make meals once a week together during COVID. And the conversation that kept coming up and among the men was always they would talk about the best way to prepare something. And so inevitably some person would say, no, Kenji debunked that. And so I made these T-shirts for our pod that said that. Like, but Kenji Lopez became like a spiritual leader to these men.
He talked about this when his last book came out. I interviewed him. And it's interesting, though, because yes, he did end up taking on that role, but, like, I always felt like at his core he was just like a nerd who was really, really excited to teach you things. You like you're not gonna believe it, like, I cooked 47 different eggs and, like, this is the best way to make a hard-boiled egg.
Yes.
And most of the food that he cooked that he would analyze and study and do these scientific experiments with, they weren't the most complex high-end things.
Right.
So that's one thing I always loved about Kenji, was that he wasn't trying to impress you with how complex a recipe was or how obscure a dish was that he had gone to the farthest end of the earth to bring back to you. It was just like, here's a thing you've made 100 times, but I'm just such a nerd that I want to find the best way to do it. And yes, I think that it became a certain portion of his followers of like, I know the best way to do it. Kenji says this is how you grill. But like, I don't think he intended for it to be that way.
Yeah. I mean, what you describe about him is a little bit like you too, just like this excitement and obsession about look what I discovered and what I want to.
For sure.
What I'm very moved by in The Sporkful is that you, I don't want to say it picks up where Bourdain left off because he became such a cult of personality also. But what I loved about Anthony Bourdain was that he used food as a way of showing how people live and how food is a way of traveling and moving and also of connection. And I do see that there's an aspect of what you're doing that is very similar to that.
For sure. Yeah. Although it didn't start out that way.
Yeah.
And when I first launched The Sporkful, it's funny, it almost is the opposite. In some ways, it's the opposite now of what it was when I launched. When I launched The Sporkful, it was about, like, let's pick a basic food and let's analyze it in the most ridiculous possible detail. Like, how granular can we get?
Right.
And so early episodes we did, I did a whole episode, like 25 minutes on ice cubes.
Yeah.
Like, what is the ideal surface area to volume ratio of ice cubes, depending on how fast you want it to melt? What's the weather? What's the beverage?
Mm.
How quickly do you want it to be chilled versus how quickly do you want it to be diluted? Grilled cheese sandwich, like how many things can you add to it before it ceases to be a grilled cheese?
Hmm.
What's the best buffet strategy? The ethics of snack mix. It was just like, let's analyze in ridiculous detail. And that was what the show was for the first 3 or 4 years. And then I started to get a little burnt out on that. And also, like, as the world of podcasting grew and long form storytelling, and there was more, a more personal element, I was like, well, how can I incorporate more of that.
Yes.
And that was also around the time when I got the Sporkful to the point that it became a job. Like, it was like a side project for 3 or 4 years.
So what were you doing for your job at that point?
I mean, I was freelancing. I was helping to produce other people's podcasts, other audio projects. I worked on a couple of kind of like digital political things that were kind of like outgrowths of Air America. So I kind of hopped around. I had a couple of full-time jobs back at Air America as it was kind of running out of money.
Yeah.
You know, I freelanced at SiriusXM, like whatever I could do to pay the bills.
Yeah.
But then around 2014, as podcasting was starting to take off, I had friends in public radio because one of the jobs I had that I got laid off from was at NPR.
Yeah.
And so I heard that the folks at WNYC, New York Public Radio, were interested in growing their podcasts. And I, you know, through connections, started chatting with them.
Yeah.
And eventually they picked me up and gave me a salary and a producer. So that was a big step up. And around then, that's when I started saying, all right, how do I take this show to the next level? And over time, it took a year or two to evolve.
Yeah.
But it became what you're saying, that sort of Bourdain-esque kind of thing of like, from food, you can go anywhere.
Yes.
You can talk about history, culture, economics, business, science, relationships. You can talk about anything. So it started off being this thing of like, let's just get narrower and narrower and more specific and granular to like, actually, let's flip it and take the starting point and how far out wide can we take
it? Yeah. I mean, when I've heard you get granular, you remind me of kids that I grew up with. My best friend from high school, we would have those kinds of conversations. And yeah, I mean, I didn't hear the Ice Cube episode, but
That's a deep cut. That was like episode two.
but you did. I mean, it's funny, like one of your talking points of the season is this ice cream sandwich that you developed in my neighborhood at this ice cream shop in Park Slope. And hearing you talk about, you know, what you were thinking about and just notebooks full of ideas of how you would make an ice cream sandwich and cereal and this and that. It's like, it kind of feels like a guy I went to camp with, you know, a little bit.
Yeah.
Whereas the conversation around, for example, the relationship of McDonald's and the black business community that I heard recently is a much wider view of how food operates in society.
For sure. And, you know, I love, as the show has evolved, I love that we cover food with so much breadth.
Yeah.
Some weeks the show can be very funny and silly. Some weeks the show can be very serious. Some weeks it's a mix. Some weeks you learn a lot. Some weeks you just get entertained.
Yeah.
Some weeks I'm the main character. Some weeks it's my job to mostly shut up and just ask a few good questions and get out of the way. And so that keeps it fun and fresh for me, but I think also for listeners. And I love the feeling, like the new episodes come out on Mondays, and I love the feeling that like listeners are going to open up their phone or their podcasting app Monday morning and like, they have no idea what we're going to throw at them. You know, it could be anything.
Yeah. You know, you refer to yourself as the main character sometimes. Where and how did you manage to decide how much of yourself, your family, your daughters are in it sometimes, your wife is in it sometimes? You know, I heard you talk to Dan Savage where you were like asking for like relationship advice with your wife about how to handle certain things. How do you manage figuring out, you know, when to draw certain boundaries around your life and when to just let yourself tell it all?
For a long time, I was very reluctant, especially like to put my kids on, mostly just because it's like, I mean, you may remember, like, remember when Kathy Lee Gifford was the host of the Today Show and she had a kid named Cody?
All the time.
And she kept talking about Cody on the show and it became a, like, a, she got, started getting made fun of for how much time she was talking about her kid and how great her kid was. And of course, like, it's sort of a running joke. Every parent thinks their kid's so great. So I didn't want to be that guy. So I didn't want to be the guy who's always putting my kids on the show because I think they're so adorable when in reality they're just, you know,
a couple of kids.
A lot of adorable kids out there. And so I was reluctant. And then, so I mean, the first big thing was like, I set out to invent a new shape of pasta, which basically like in the mid 2010s when podcasting was really taking off and cereal went viral and like it was driven by public radio and long form storytelling and like a Netflix show, like a story told in multiple parts where you have cliffhangers and people want to know what's going to happen next. And like, you know, people were doing that in audio and I was like, what would my version of that be? And I landed on, I'm going to invent a new food. And then I said, I'm going to invent a new pasta shape, partly because I have lots of opinions about pasta shapes and think a lot of the classic ones aren't very good. And partly because I just thought it would be a great story. Everyone eats pasta. And also, I thought it could be a good business. I was like, maybe this, you know, like I want to actually get it made. I want to actually sell it. Maybe it'll take off. Who knows? So I set out to do that. And it was like a 3-year process. And early on, we made the first 2 episodes. I don't know. We probably had a first draft of those 1.5 years before they came out, at least 1 year. And we did a big group edit, and I, you know, we edit all of our shows. We have an editor, and I brought in extra editors, and we had this big listen, and like, you know, what is it like? Because I just wanted, like, are we on the right track here? Like, I don't have the rest of the story yet, but I want to know before we make the rest of the story,
Will this work?
Will this work? And like, give me some feedback on what is working, what's not working, so that I can use that to inform the rest of the story. And the number one note, so like, what, maybe I'm, this might be like public radio podcasting, like.
No, I want to go there with you. I have a lot of questions.
But so like, two of the most influential long form podcast stories of the mid 2010s. One was Planet Money, the NPR economics podcast, Planet Money.
You know, Robert lives on this block.
Right. Well, we're old friends, yeah. Right? Robert's great. Yeah. And they did a whole thing. They designed a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And they told a multi-part story about the, not just the what logo would be on, but it was about like, where was the cotton for the shirt grown?
Yeah.
Where was it processed? Where was the shirt made? And it was a story about the global economy. How did the components of the shirt and the shirt itself go all the way around the world to end up at your doorstep? And it went viral, and they sold a ton of t-shirts. So many t-shirts that NPR didn't know what to do with all the money because they had never made money before. they had no policy for that. So there was that. And Alex Bloomberg was also with Robert, one of the big guys behind that project. Then Alex left and he started his own company called Gimlet, which was very influential in the early days of the podcast boom. And he did a show called Startup, which was about him starting his own podcast company.
Yes.
And that was also a big influence on me.
And you borrowed from the language of both of those. Like, now that I think of it, talking to your wife where she says to you, I don't know if you should be using 100%. Your talents for pasta is very much like Alex talking to his wife where she's saying to him, like, this is crazy, you know, right. You're going to put all of our money into this business
sort of
or whatever.
Late night confessional, yes, with your wife, crisis of confidence moment, I absolutely took from Alex.
Yeah.
But if you look at those two stories, the Planet Money t-shirt story and Startup, the Planet Money t-shirt one is more journalistic and it's more about like, you're going to learn something about this process.
Yeah.
Startup is more personal. Alex is the main character. When I started off on my podcast series about the making of my pasta, I thought that the Planet Money t-shirt story was my lodestar. Like, that was what I was trying to do. So I was like, I'm going to go to where the wheat is grown.
Yeah.
In North Dakota is where the highest portion of the wheat used to make pasta in America comes from North Dakota. I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
To the pasta lab in North Dakota State University. And that was what I was focusing on. So we did this first edit,
yeah,
of the first episode or two. And the number one note was, we don't want to know as much about where the wheat comes from.
Yeah.
We want Dan,
yeah,
to be struggling. We want to hear about your,
yeah,
pain and suffering. We want to hear about your frustrations. We want to hear what's going through your head. We want to hear the behind the scenes of your process. So what they were essentially saying is, we want you to be the main character of this. And what I heard also is like, less Planet Money t-shirt,
yeah,
more Startup. And so that was when I was like, all right, I get it.
I have to be in this.
Right. And that sort of pushed me to make myself more the main character, which I had been reticent to do, and to talk to my wife and record her and bring my kids into it. And then people loved that. And to this day, I mean, that series launched in 2021. Here we are 4.5 years later.
Yeah.
And people still come up to me and they're like, Janie, your wife, oh my God, she's the greatest. I loved her in that pasta series. She's the best.
And it won awards. It definitely moved the thing forward,
for
the
sure.
whole project,
yeah,
forward.
And the pasta was a hit.
So I want to talk about the pasta. So I'm off gluten for 9 months. I heard the episode asking about whether or not is gluten better in Europe. I go to Europe a lot as a musician, and I still haven't tested the theory.
You got
to
give it a shot.
I know. Everybody says that I actually may be better off, although I heard you talk about maybe it's all smoke
right.
and mirrors. I don't know.
The science is still out.
Yeah.
You know, partly it's just that people go on vacation and they tend to eat slower and the portions in Europe are smaller and
yeah.
they tend to walk a lot more. So you're a lot more active.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of different factors that
yeah.
could be at play.
There's a pasta place in the neighborhood called Pasta Louise over here. I don't know
yeah,
if you know
yeah.
about it.
I haven't been, but I've heard of it.
It became the trendiest thing in the sort of like late COVID era of the neighborhood. And their thing is they have one pasta shape each day.
Right.
The shape is this today. And then, so it's just a question of which sauces you're going to get. And that's how you order.
I do love that.
And that's a very you kind of thing because
yeah.
all of the shapes are designed to collect the sauce, which is your
right.
major
although some
argument.
Are much better at it than others.
Well, that's a big part of what you're talking about.
Right. Yeah, so when I set out to invent my own pasta shape, I had these three metrics that I developed to judge all pasta shapes. One is forkability, how easy is it to get it on your fork and keep it there.
Yeah.
Sauceability, how well does the sauce adhere
yeah.
to the shape. And what I call tooth sinkability.
Yeah.
How satisfying is it to bite into it.
Yeah.
And a lot of pasta shapes have one or two of those. Very few have all three.
Yeah. What are some of the pasta shapes that you felt kind of hit the mark?
I love strozza pretti, which means the pre-strangler, or casareccia. Those are both like very, very similar to each other.
Uh-huh.
They're short shapes. Each one is roughly speaking, like imagine if you had a flat square and you took one end and started just rolling it up towards the center
yeah.
halfway, but then you flipped it over and rolled the other half towards the center in the opposite direction. And so if you looked at the cross section, it would almost be like an S shape.
Yeah.
But it's like a stick.
Yep.
But because it's an S shape and it's got openings, so like tubes don't hold sauce as well as people think they do.
Penne is not a good sauce holder.
You know, rigatoni, ziti, like I will defy anyone. Like you have to toss it and toss it with the sauce to even get it to go 25% of the way into the tube.
Yep.
Nooks and crannies and cracks and crevices hold sauce much better. So Casareccia and Strozzapreti. I love a shape. Mafalda was very influential to me. That's like fettuccine, but with ruffles down the edges. I mean, look, there are some, like, orecchiette isn't the greatest for holding sauce, but it's, like, so meaty
noodle,
and so satisfying and very easy to, like, you can eat that with a spoon. But, like, spaghetti, which is the most popular shape, the most commonly sold and eaten shape, doesn't do any of my metrics. Like, it's hard to get a good bite on your fork.
Well, I think, though, that the argument is, like, having gone to Italy and having had friends prepare pasta or whatever, it's like there's almost no sauce sometimes. Like, it's just about the way the pasta is cooked to the exact point of it's all about the pasta for some, and I almost think that spaghetti traditionally was like, no, it's not about dumping all this sauce on it, it's about like the pasta itself
for sure, but like there is still something on it that you want to stick to it. And I think that there are some great spaghetti dishes that I have had in Italy and loved, but like, you know, the main reason why spaghetti is so common is that it's the first shape that was industrialized. So like the way that pasta, you know, any industrially produced pasta, like non-handmade pasta is made, like remember the Play-Doh factory?
Yes.
You'd have that little like star-shaped disc and you'd put the Play-Doh in and you press it, you crank it through and it comes out in a shape like a star. That's how pasta is made. And you have that little, instead of that little star-shaped disc, you have a tube like spaghetti or a big circle like to make rigatoni or whatever it is. And so spaghetti, it was the first shape that was industrialized, so it's very common.
Yeah.
But it's also, it's very primitive. It's very simple.
Yeah.
And so I just feel like, you know, we could do better. Like, yeah, there's a lot of great pasta dishes in Italy that are made with spaghetti, but like they might be a little better with mafalda, like a flat pasta with some ruffles on it.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't hate spaghetti, but I do think it's overrated and overused.
Yes.
It's really hard to get a good bite on your fork.
Yep.
It's always too much or too little. It has danglers that get stuff all over your face.
Yes.
And then like, yeah, if it's really good spaghetti cooked just right, it can be too sinkable.
Yeah.
But it's not especially forkable or sauceable.
Yes. And has it turned into a business?
Yeah, the pasta. So the original version of Cascatelli is made by a company called Sfoglini in upstate New York. It's spelled S-F-O-G-L-I-N-I. It's the G silent. But it's in stores around America. They sell it on their website. It's Sfoglini.com. So yeah, you can buy it. You have it shipped to your door. And yeah, it's amazing. I still get excited when I see it in a store. I still buy it sometimes, even though I don't have to, because it's just like fun for me.
It must be so exciting to see it in a store. I mean, it's a little bit like hearing your song on the radio or something. It's like, oh my God, this actually exists in the world. This is a real thing.
For sure. And it's like, you know, super exciting for my kids now. It's been, the pasta came out in 2021. So they've like grown up, you know, and they were involved in the testing. And then it came out. Like, you know, most people, you have some success in your job.
Yeah.
Your kids don't really care.
Yes.
Inventing a new shape of pasta, that was something they could get excited about.
Yeah.
You know, and like they would be on the school bus and their friends would be like, I had your dad's pasta for dinner last night. You know, so that was one of the coolest things about it. It was like my whole family was really excited and proud. And my kids could understand it as some kind of like a cool success. And their friends would come up to them and tell them about it. So that was really cool.
Well, you know, I understand maybe they're not podcast consumers at this moment in their life. So that doesn't really resonate. But you did get in very early and you're still here, which says a lot. But what I want to know is how you, and I want to know for asking for a friend, how you turned it into a business. I mean, what were the steps that you took to turn a podcast into a profitable experiment?
I mean, the step one was starting it really early. You know, I don't think the Sporkful would be as successful if I was trying to launch it today.
Yeah.
Because there's so much noise and so much competition. So I was able to build a small following and also get the show more dialed in.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays, you don't get 4 years. You know, you launched a podcast, you wouldn't get 4 years to figure it out.
Yes.
You know, but because no one was listening to podcasts for my first 4 years, that's what I got.
Yeah.
So, you know, you can't go back in time and fix that now.
Yeah.
The other things are, I mean, look, never underestimate the power of desperation. Like I said, I had been laid off from 6 jobs in 8 years. When I launched The Sporkful in 2010, I was 33. I was married. My first kid was going to be coming soon. It's like, you know, I wasn't in my 20s anymore. You can't just sort of like mess around forever. Like you do need a career. You know, like you need to become an adult at some point.
Hmm.
When I decided to start my own podcast, I really felt like this is my last chance to have a career in quote unquote radio or audio. And so I was desperate. And so I threw myself into it with an intensity and an obsession that I was able to maintain for many years and still have to a large degree, although like I've mellowed a bit in my older age and as I've started to feel like the Sporkful is on stable footing. But
was it always once a week?
There were periods that it was every other week,
yeah,
depending on what else I was doing in my life.
Yeah, which again speaks to the fact that you can, you know, ramp it up and slow it down on your own terms.
I mean, then you could. Now I couldn't because like you have to sell ads and all that stuff. When you have no ads, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
When we first launched, it was every other week and then it was weekly and then it went back to every other week and then it went back to weekly.
And you were alone for the first couple of years or did you have somebody working
with
you?
I had a co-host at times. I had a friend of mine coming through. So like I would talk to different folks.
Yeah.
And then I was solo, you know, then I would switch to sort of interviewing people more. So it's changed and evolved a lot.
You always cut it or you had somebody editing it? Did you do all the
technical
stuff?
I mean, in the first few years, I edited it. I composed the theme music in GarageBand. I'm sure you would laugh at how basic it was.
I'm sure it was great.
But it worked. It was free, and I had the rights to it. I sold the ads. I wrote the blog posts. I did the social media. I mean, there's no part of the work of making a podcast, either the production and creative work or the business side of things, that I haven't done.
Yes.
And so there was just an insane amount of hustle in those early years to drum up opportunities, to get guests, to keep making it better, to get that first opportunity at WNYC, to evolve the show. And then I left WNYC and followed a couple of the executives who had brought me in there, who I really liked, to Stitcher, which was a for-profit. So I left the nonprofit world and went into the for-profit world. And that was also great because they're just better, much better at selling ads, frankly. But I continue to this day to work really closely with the ad salespeople. Yeah. You know, like, yes, I love the creative side of it. I love hosting and I'll still go into a Pro Tools session and cut tape and I go through the scripts and edit everything and weigh in on the blog posts and all that. I still do my own social media, but I'm also meeting with the ad salespeople and going to presentations at ad agencies and trying to sell the ads and meeting with the marketing people. And like, so like I'm also behind the scenes, I'm still, to, you know, 15 years in, very focused on the business side of things,
yeah.
You know, and you have to be.
Well, and also there's as much to nerd out about on that side of it as there is on the creative side of it. Like, what is the strategy here and how are we approaching this? And, you know, if you're somebody who likes to get your hands dirty, there's plenty to get dirty in there too.
Yeah, it was a combination of, I already had 8 or 10 years of audio experience when I launched my podcast.
Yes.
Even if you hadn't hosted anything, like you are an audio professional.
Yes.
And so when you launched your podcast, you already had highly attuned ears.
Yes.
And so, you know, the great blessing and curse of podcasting is that anyone can start a podcast. So now anyone does. So I had some expertise and experience.
Yes.
But also I had this sort of intensity and drive,
yes,
which I think is also what you need. But I have come to find the business side of things to also be gratifying.
Yeah.
I was talking to a guy who runs a workshop festival for podcasters about maybe doing some kind of presentation about the business stuff. And he said, you know, half the people who come to our festival say, we want to hear about the business side of things. And half of them say, no business. We don't want any of the business. And I get that like some podcast gatherings and conferences and festivals are very businessy and it's all like ad people and agents and all that. And, you know, of course, I don't ever want to lose sight of the creative side of things. But if your attitude is like, I don't want to talk about the business thing, I only want to hear about craft, well, you're not going to be practicing your craft for very long.
Yeah. One of the notes that I took on listening to your podcast was the way ads integrate and work in the project. I mean, first of all, you tend to read a lot of them yourself. It seems like most of them. So you have to believe in it. You have to be comfortable with it. Sometimes it leads to funny things like an episode about Shabbat followed by like a 2-minute celebration of the virtues of pork.
Right.
But on the other hand, like that's a move. That's a decision that you make, that the ads are going to be kind of woven into it through coming from you.
For sure. And part of that is just my early jobs in radio were in commercial, yeah, talk radio. I've never been quite as precious as some people in sort of the nonprofit public radio world about selling,
yeah,
myself and other things.
Yeah.
Like, and I think that in today's world, if you want, like, I've been doing this program for 15 years.
Yeah.
It's a successful business now, and I still own it.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. But like, that's in part because I don't mind doing the ads and hawking things. And like it's part of the job.
Yeah.
And I want the ads to sound good because it's part of the listening experience. So it's also part of the quality of the show.
Right.
But it's also part of the thing that pays for the show and allows me to do things creatively that I get excited about. And we did an episode earlier this year where I went to Birmingham, Alabama and drove to Memphis,
yeah,
and stopped at 5 gas stations along the way because there's a whole culture around Southern gas stations and the food at the gas stations. That costs money to do that, for me to fly there and rent a car and drive and stay in a hotel and buy all the food and fly home. And so, yeah, if hawking some stuff in the mid-roll break in a way that is pretty easy for me,
yeah,
pays for me to do a really cool episode of my podcast that other people might not have the budget for, like, to me, that's time well spent.
Well, no, and in fact, that's where the business and the craft align.
Right.
Like, for you to say, we can't talk about one without the other. I mean, like, literally in your project, they're interwoven.
Right.
You're making ads.
And like, the biggest thing I ever did, this whole pasta thing, like, I was sitting on that idea for a year. I needed to be able to hire a second producer. I have two full-time producers now, but back then I only had one. And I was like, this is such a big project. It's such a big undertaking that I need one producer to be able to crank out shows every week while I have a second producer who's just doing this huge project with me on the side for like a year.
Yeah.
So again, how are you going to get a second producer? Like, they're not just going to give you a second producer. You got to show that you can support it.
You had to really believe that there was something there, that there was a real potential in investing years plus in telling a story that nobody was going to hear for a long time.
Yes, I did think there was real potential. I mean, like I said, I was sort of inspired by a startup, and my number one priority was to tell a great story.
Yeah.
My number two priority was to invent a great pasta shape.
Yeah.
My number three priority was that it would become a successful business. I mean, I must have said to my producer, Emma, five times, I was like, it almost doesn't matter if the pasta shape is good or not. I just want to tell a great story. But also what I was thinking was like, really what you want for that is for it to be incredibly successful or a total disaster. The worst outcome would have been like middling success. That's the least interesting ending of a story. If I had gone to the end of the earth to try to make this pasta shape and it had completely crashed and burned and I had lost whatever money I invested in it and been left in the gutter crying, that would have been a good story, you know? Or he invented a shape of pasta, and at the end, there's all these people saying, oh my God, this is really good.
Yes.
I didn't think you were going to be able to do this, but it's actually really good.
Yes.
That's also a great ending. But I went in knowing, like, this is going to be hard.
Yeah.
Things will go wrong. And when things go wrong, that creates conflict and drama, and those are the components of a great story.
Yes.
I didn't know how wrong things would go and how hard it would be. That ended up making it an even better story than I had hoped. But, like, I went in feeling like things are going to go wrong. There will be drama and conflict, and hopefully it will either be a huge success or a total disaster.
Yes. Well, it seems like it paid off. I mean, it was a risk. Obviously, you had to hire a second producer. You had to put all this other work into, because you're also, at the same time, you're also producing regular episodes, and it paid off. Did it lead to more, from a podcast standpoint, did it grow the podcast? I know it won awards. Did the audience grow?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it didn't double the audience. I think at my point where, like, my audience isn't going to double based on anything I do. Like, it's just sort of like a slow, steady, like, hopefully the numbers keep going up slow and steady. You're always going to be losing listeners just because they move on to the next thing.
Interesting.
So you have to get new listeners just to stay, to break even. We definitely got new listeners, and it also became like a calling card of the show now. Like, so many people heard of the, even if they didn't become a hardcore Sporkful listener, so many people heard about this viral pasta.
Yeah.
If I go to a meeting and I'll tell them, oh, you know, and oh, by the way, I invented this pasta shape, they're often like, oh, yeah. Oh, you're that guy. You know, it led to me writing a cookbook, which also became a story on the podcast and became a thing that, you know, it's like, this is a bit of an annoying term, you know, in sort of corporate VC startup world, but you want to get, like, they talk about like a flywheel where like each thing is feeding the next thing.
Yes.
So that's sort of what the pasta set up for me that I didn't have before from a business perspective, which is like the podcast is telling the story of the pasta, the box of the pasta mentions the podcast. So people who listen to the podcast find the pasta, people who find the pasta find the podcast.
Yeah, and the book.
And then the book, you get into it and the book promotes both things. Again, at the end of the day, like, there's a million business ideas I have that I don't do because I feel like either they don't feel right or they're not great ideas. I'm not going to do things that I'm not excited about creatively. I have to be excited about it creatively to pursue it as a business opportunity.
Yes.
But when I have five different things that I'm excited about creatively all at the same time, I'm going to then be like, all right, which one of these makes sense in the business front?
Yes.
And so that's also a deciding factor.
I noticed that at some point you started just revisiting
reheats
of old episodes. And I realized hearing you talk that, right, that because there's so much churn and turnover in your audience, that if there is attrition, then you have to assume a lot of your listeners didn't hear these episodes from, you know, 5 years ago, whatever it is.
Right, for sure. And also, we've been releasing shows every week. We went to weekly in probably 2014, 2015.
Yeah.
And have been for 10 years. So we made a lot of episodes.
Yeah.
So even hardcore listeners haven't heard all of them. My wife hasn't heard half of them.
Yeah.
Even if you were a listener 5 years ago, you might not have heard this one.
Yeah.
You know, and we used to have like a premium subscription service when we were part of Stitcher. And so that was the thing, like a new episode would come out and it would be in the feed for 6 months. And after that, it would go into the premium service. And if you were a subscriber, you could listen to the archive. And then they just did away with that.
Yeah.
So then everyone started writing to us like, how do I listen? Oh, I wanted to share that old episode with my friend and I can't find it. So we were like, what do we do about this? Let's just start every Friday. The new episodes come out Monday. Every Friday, we're going to drop one of our classic episodes into the feed. And it will be all the things. It will be for newer listeners who didn't hear it the first time, old listeners who missed it, and people who did hear it the last time but want to hear it again, who've been writing to us saying, hey, I want to hear that one again.
Right. New intro.
Yeah, we put a new intro at the top.
Yep.
But we don't make many other changes otherwise, partly just because we are still a small team.
Yeah.
If I started updating things and retracking things in the middle, then it has to be remixed.
Yeah.
And then it becomes a big lift for our team. So we just can't manage that.
So what is your general like life organization like? What is your schedule like?
I mean, it changes a bit every week, which I like.
Yeah.
Mondays is usually the busiest day. I mean, basically, we have several months of episodes planned out roughly.
Yeah.
Different episodes are always in different stages of production. The episodes come out Monday. The previous Monday, we edit the next week's episode. So it's already been edited, and I've gone through it, and producers, there's been back and forth. But this is when we all, you know, four of us with our editor who hasn't heard it, and the other producer who's not on that episode hasn't really heard it, and we go through the whole episode. And then we spend like an hour discussing it, picking it apart, and then those notes get incorporated on Tuesday. I track it. It goes to the engineer later in the week, and then it gets finalized Friday and goes up Monday. So that's like the flow of a week. Zooming out, it kind of varies. Like here I am in Brooklyn today hanging out with you.
And it's a Tuesday.
Today's a Tuesday. I come into the city more often Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Some weeks I'm doing more taping. Some weeks I'm doing more editing. Some weeks I'm traveling.
Yeah.
I like that, not, you know, that every week's a little different.
What about video and integrating video? That seems like something that everybody's dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm passionate about audio.
Yeah, me too.
That's how I got into this field.
Yeah.
I've done TV. I've done stuff on Cooking Channel. I've enjoyed it. It's perfectly fine. It's never been a thing that I was super passionate about. But YouTube is now the number one place for people to listen to podcasts.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not kind of at the point where I'm not even sure what a podcast is. Like, the line between a TV show or an online show and a podcast is starting to disintegrate. So I could probably continue to make the Sporkful. My current audience that's been listening for many years probably isn't going to go to YouTube because they're longtime podcast listeners. But if I want to get any new listeners, I should be on YouTube. So that's something that I'm thinking a lot about. I'm always very reticent of jumping on the latest digital trend because everything changes so fast. Like, remember when Facebook video came out? Everyone's like, Facebook wants you to do video. So if you posted a video on Facebook, Facebook would show it to 100 million people because they wanted you to think that this was going to be so great. And then 6 months later, they were like, ah, never mind.
Yeah.
But I think the idea of YouTube and podcasting is here to stay.
Yes.
So that's something that I'm thinking a lot about. It's like, what's the best strategy for it?
The thing that's a little bit frustrating to me about it is I agree with you that I love audio. I also don't believe that radio or audio is TV without the images.
Right.
It's a different format. It's a different way of telling stories. And I listen to your show. It's cut in a much more thoughtful way than you even realize. And when you're laying in new audio on top of, you know, the interview that you did somewhere else and like that, that's not easy to recreate visually. Your show is not always just four people sitting around a table talking. So it doesn't necessarily translate, as I would think, as a visual show.
Well, that's one of the challenges, right? Is that any old school podcast that's audio only, that does any kind of long form storytelling or that is heavily edited or that has scripting.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's one thing to make a video of two people talking and just post that video.
Yes.
When it's edited, it's much more challenging. YouTube is promising AI tools that are going to solve that. And, you know, you can upload the audio and they'll create an AI video that just sort of like animates the whole story. I think that's probably still a ways away.
Yeah.
I agree with you that audio is its own thing. I, for my entire career, going back to Air America 20 plus years ago, have always been very frustrated and frankly angered by people who think that audio is just like video without pictures.
Yeah.
A lot of the people they hired early on at Air America were TV people who all came into this radio thing, and I wanted to be in radio, and they were all like, they all had a sort of arrogance about them, many of them, an arrogance of like, well, this is easy.
Yeah.
You know, because I just don't need to worry about what the pictures.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, it's harder because you can kind of cheat when you have visuals. I mean, yes, of course, creating compelling and moving visuals is a great skill.
Yes.
I don't want to diminish that skill, but like, you can also just sort of like, sort of, you dangle a lot of enough shiny objects in front of people and you can kind of trick them into thinking that what you're doing is substantive or compelling or exciting just by like cutting from one grabby visual to another fast enough.
Yes.
And you just can't do that as well in audio. Like you just can't hide as much behind your production. And I also just think that there's something inherently interactive about listening only to the spoken word, because as you said at the beginning, my face, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, when you're listening to the spoken word, you're imagining whatever the people are talking about. You're imagining what they look like.
Where they are.
You know, people would always ask me, how do you do food in audio? Food is so visual. And it's like, well, yeah, but if I describe a cheeseburger to you and I start talking about it sizzling on the grill and the juice is coming out and you melt the cheese on top and you have a nice toasty bun, maybe there's lettuce and tomato on top, maybe not. And maybe there's ketchup or mustard or both or pickles or not. Maybe it's just, maybe there's three pieces of cheese. You just like it extra cheesy. Whatever I describe of your cheeseburger, every person who's listening is going to get a bespoke image in their head of what that cheeseburger looks like. And you, the listener, created it. Like spoken word audio is the original user-generated content.
Yes.
You are creating the visual in your head. And that is why it connects more deeply with people, because you are in part creating the experience yourself and it's bespoke to you. And so, yes, it saddens me that video, I think, corrupts that. At the same time, as we said, I have to find a balance between the creative pursuits that I like and running a business.
You talk about YouTube as promising AI tools. Where are you at with just AI in general and the idea of integrating it into the process?
We use it a little bit. There's a program called Descript that we use a lot, which is pretty cool. I don't use it a ton, actually. My producers do mostly, but for folks who don't know, it's basically like you upload the audio, it creates a text transcript of the audio. And the first tool that they had, which was really cool, that kind of got them attention in the audio world, was that you could make edits in the text document and they would automatically make those cuts in the audio tape, which is pretty amazing. That blew my mind already. Now they're starting to do the same thing with video.
Yes.
So even if you don't know how to cut video, you can just go into the text transcript of the video, highlight 30 seconds and say, make that into a clip for me to put on Instagram. And it will do that.
Yes.
So that's pretty incredible also. So there are some pretty cool tools. You know, look, the whole world of AI is, you know, two parts scary, one part exciting. We'll see how it all pans out. I don't think it's going to be all the roses that people who make AI want us to believe it will be.
Right, but hopefully it also won't be the end of humanity, like some naysayers.
Yeah, I'm always skeptical when people start saying, that people have been predicting the end of time pretty much since the beginning of time, so we made it this far.
Yes. So, you know, let me see if I can draw this parallel. I come from basically a sort of a jazz background. It's not my only musical life or love, but it's a big part of my community. My dad is a jazz musician, and my wife is not a huge jazz fan. And so there's a lot of jazz that gets outsourced in my life. From the two of us to go hear some jazz, I have to say to her, like, this one, you know, you're really going to like this one. You grew up kind of secular Jewish, not particularly worrying about keeping a kosher house. And your wife is more traditional in her food habits. She's, if it were up to her, she would probably keep a properly kosher house.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I don't cook pork in our house. I don't cook shellfish in our house. I don't usually mix meat and dairy. And my wife, like, she wouldn't eat a cheeseburger, but like, she really loves chicken parm and she kind of breaks the rules for that.
Uh-huh.
So she's not so observant. And we have a sort of compromise that I think works well enough. But the difference is more that she doesn't care that much about food.
Yeah.
You know, she grew up, like, her mom's a very good cook, but like, her parents came from Czechoslovakia and they're Eastern European, very sort of like meat and potato style. And my wife didn't grow up going out to a lot of restaurants. She doesn't get the same amount of pleasure from food as I do. She just doesn't care as much. So similar to your wife. I'm sure your wife, like, does she like other kinds of music?
She likes other kinds of music, and she also loves a lot of other things that, you know, it's, but this is an area in our lives where I sometimes think people, if they have a relationship with me because of my podcast or the music that I make or whatever, they might assume that when they walk in the room, she's going to be equally part of this conversation.
Right.
And she's kind of like, that's actually not totally my thing. That's his thing. And I, when I heard this conversation that you had, I think it was with Dan Savage where you're talking about it, I thought, I feel a kind of kinship this conversation.
Yeah. And it, you know, I go back and forth on it. Right. Same as you, though, I'm sure. Like, people meet me and they're like, oh, your wife must be really into food. You guys must go out to restaurants all the time. I'm like, well, she doesn't really care that much. She's also frugal. So she doesn't like to spend money on a meal that I could have made.
Right.
So I could have made something that she would have liked just as much. There are times when I wish we could bond over that a little bit more. And I wish that we could enjoy a meal out a little more without her worrying what it costs. Not that I would go out so often anyway, but like if you're going to go out and you're going to spend the money, enjoy it, I would say. But the flip side is that, like, you know, I like being married to someone who is in a totally different field from my field and who kind of has, you know, cares a little bit about the inner workings of my job. I mean, she is very supportive, but she doesn't care that much about the inner workings. And so it sort of keeps me grounded and, like, I don't fall too much into, like, this navel-gazy vibe of, like, my whole world being food and restaurants and podcasting. So I think it sort of helps to give me a good perspective in that way. So I think, like, it's, you know, it's a good balance.
Yeah. This is a question that I have asked a lot of, particularly musicians, when they get into these music or creative power couples, you know, because, you know, you describe it as navel-gazy. I also have at times romanticized the idea of, like, God, wouldn't it be great to come home at the end of the day and just, like, engage fully and deeply on the process of the thing that I'm thinking about. Sometimes I feel like I wish I could just play you a half-finished thing and have you be able to sort of extrapolate where I'm going with it as opposed to just, you know, having a fixed opinion. Is it good? Is it not good? But on the other hand, as you say, it's very enriching and probably better long term to not live always inside that same swamp. You know?
I mean, I don't know that I'd say one is better than the other. Like, you know, in the great, like, it's worked out great for me overall and, you know, very happy. And, but I do hear you. There are times that, like, because I love nerding out on process and I would be very happy to, like, talk for, you know, 15 minutes about this one section of an episode and, like, whatever. And that's not something I'm going to do with my wife.
Yeah.
But, you know, you find other people in your life who will nerd out on those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Do you struggle to come up with ideas or is it still flowing freely?
Yeah, no, there's no, I've always been an ideas person. I have a million ideas. I have Google Docs full of ideas, many of which will never come to fruition. Yeah, I'm always a person who's come up with a million ideas. They're not all good.
Yeah.
But I get a lot of ideas and my issue is always like execution. Like, which one am I going to prioritize? Which one am I most excited about? Which one do I think is the best idea? Which one can I get off the ground? Which one do I have the resources and support for? I have so many ideas for a restaurant that I'm sure I will never open.
Hmm.
Partly because it would be so much work.
Yeah.
And partly because, like, it's such a terrible business. So, like, why? You know, but I always have this fantasy, like, someday, if someone were to come to me and say, listen, we want to open a restaurant. We want you to kind of be the figurehead or, like, a consultant, and you can give us ideas in the menu, and you can come and hang out there sometimes, and you can own a small piece of it. But, like, it's not, you don't need to run it. And if it goes out of business, you won't lose your home. Then I'd be like, yes.
Yes.
Let's do it. But no one has come to me with that offer.
Yeah, I mean, it is funny that food is such a big business, but actually a restaurant is a very, very hard business.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It's hard both in the sense of, like, hard financially to turn a profit, but also hard in terms of the hours and the commitment, and you're working nights and weekends. I mean, it's especially a hard industry to be in if you're going to have a family. I mean, I'm sure somewhat true for a musician, too. A lot of travel, a lot of nights and weekends.
I thought, you know, I sat at a ramen bar recently and watched my friend who owns the place operate a lunch shift. And as I was watching her welcome people in, seat them, make drinks for people, run the floor, turn the music up and down, whatever, something occurred to me, which is that much like being a performing musician, the thing about a restaurant is that it doesn't scale. Like, the best case scenario is that it's full today and that you can wake up tomorrow and do it again and hopefully be as successful tomorrow as you were today. But there's no, I mean, unless you franchise or you grow or it becomes a big chain or something, like just a single restaurant, there's very little scale in it. It has a cap in terms of what it can earn, but your work is always the same. There's no way to, like, I don't know, chill out. Like, you just have to show up and do the same work every time.
It's grueling.
It's grueling.
I feel, I think that's unlikely. But no, I have a million ideas and the hardest part is figuring out which one to prioritize.
Do you still believe in podcasting as a good business model and a good use of your time?
For me or for people in general?
Both.
For me, yes. Like, it's great. Like, I'm very fortunate, you know, that I started it when I did, was able to make mistakes I was able to get through a lot of my mistakes before it mattered too much and then make some good decisions at the right times.
Yeah.
Like I said, I started the Sporkful. It was like my last ditch effort to have the career that I now have. So it worked, you know, and so I have a steady job, and I do get to do a thing that I love, and I still...
You have employees. I mean, you
right,
have a whole...
Right, so that's incredible. So that's, like, that's great for me. In terms of the overall industry, I mean, I do worry, as we said, that the craft and connection of audio only will erode over time. That being said, I mean, human beings sitting down and talking to each other is the oldest form of media there is. Maybe cave paintings were earlier. So that's not going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
The styles will change, culture will change, technology will change, distribution methods will change, when and how and where people listen will change, and whether there's visuals, that all that will change.
Yeah.
But at its essence, human beings talking to each other and connecting is not going anywhere.
I mean, what I'm tempted to say is, Dan Pashman, thank you for talking and connecting with
that
me today.
Like a good ending,
yeah.
Leo.
As I scan my options, I think that's
right.
probably the best thing we both do is, as
you're recording, you're like editing in your head. Oh, that I'll move that part over there. Oh, this part we're gonna cut. He went on too long there. We'll strive to shorten that.
Yeah, I feel so seen by you right now, Dan. It's been such a treat to discover you more fully in these last few weeks and to finally get to put a face to the voice.
You too. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, there's one thing I want to say to you
or
propose to you. You mentioned that you were going to go to Miriam on the way. Which I love.
Right.
I just got back from Spain last week,
right,
and I have a package of Jamón Serrano that I sneaked into the country. I'm offering to open it for you if you want to have a little ham before you walk out.
I would never say no to that.
I don't want to like force food onto you.
Well, no. I'm always happy to have food forced on me. I'll take
it. So I would like to offer you some ham.
I'll be honored.
All right, come downstairs. We'll open the ham.
Let's do it.
All right.
All right, Serrano ham, first bite. Oh, man. There's like so much flavor in this little tiny thin slice. I mean, it's probably like a microgram of food, and it's just like flavor and flavor and flavor. Mm.
I feel like I am getting such a window into what you do, watching you eat something, process it, and then just have to describe it. And like the choice
it's a skill that I have had to learn over time. I haven't always been so good at it. The other issue I run into when I do food TV things sometimes is that I get excited to eat and then I take too big a bite of food. The secret is you're supposed to take a very small bite so you can swallow it and then talk.
Yeah.
And I always get really excited. I take this huge bite of it. And then I'm like trying to talk with my mouth full and they're like, who is this idiot?
Well, that is another question I have about the process of doing food media. Yeah, get in there. Doing food media is just knowing like when to control yourself, because you're going to have to eat more, you know, especially if you know you're going to eat a couple of meals in a day or something, like just making, that's not an issue for you.
I mean,
I'm going to go into,
you know how they always say that like the flavor of the ham is affected by what the pigs eat?
Yeah.
And I always think that 99% of the time that's bullshit. I'm like, no, this actually tastes kind of like, is it acorns?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm like, actually it tastes so nutty and woody. I guess maybe it's true when you have the really good stuff, which this is. Oh, man. My job doesn't actually involve that much eating.
Yeah.
Here's the truth. I mean, like, you know, the number of times that I'm taping something and eating is like once every couple of weeks.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I guess it's sort of part of my, I make it part of my job to eat well when I can. So I know what people are talking about and I have some opinions and, you know, I'm somewhat up on culture.
Yeah.
But it's, I'm not a chef. I'm not a judge on a competition show. I'm not a restaurant critic.
Yeah.
So most of the time it's like not an issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
That you can talk about food without having to eat it all the time. Should we do one more of these?
All right. If you insist.
Yeah, let's do a third one. Let's do it's a third.
Oh, you dropped a piece on the floor. Eat it off the floor. Don't you dare.
I'm going to. I do. I'm not afraid to.
Good, good. Because I would have eaten it if you hadn't.
Mm. Oh, man. It's so good.
You know what's amazing about this is it's like all glisteny.
I know.
And juicy.
Yeah.
It's just like, because like so much, so often it can be dry. It's a real treat.
For the first time, because I've been going to Spain for a long time, I was warned when I bought it that it's actually not legal. They said, you know, they will take this away from you if they find it.
Right.
Which I guess is because of the way it's prepared or something, or I'm not sure.
Well, I don't know that you can bring any meat, technically. I've done it too.
But not even prosciutto. It's not about prosciutto versus Jamón Serrano or whatever.
I don't think so. I don't think you're allowed to bring meat from other countries. Well, next time you're in Spain, if you got room for an extra package,
I got you.
I'll be happy to stop back by.
I got you. I've had so fun to do this with you, Dan.
There he was, my friends, Dan Pashman. passion, obsession, strategy, and tenacity. I love it. I'll be back in your headspace before you know it with another deep dive. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.